This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldon. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted, the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat. Welcome to episode 344 of the Outlander podcast. I am Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander.
This episode, we'd like to thank co-producer Kate O. We will chat a little bit more at the very end. Stay tuned to find out what a co-producer means, what they do, what they is, I guess so, and how you can become a co-producer if you're interested. Summer, do we have any announcements?
The only announcement that I have is that you guys are so amazing because, and I'll tell you why.
Yeah, I know why.
We put,
and she didn't tell me this before.
So we added the link on TeePublic for masks last week, and we announced that we would be donating all the proceeds from the mask sales to through the end of the year to Broadway Cares. Like Equity Fights COVID, I'm assuming it is a branch of Equity Fights AIDS, which is a very well-known Broadway equity.
It is Broadway Cares Equity Fights AIDS. That's the name of the foundation or the group, but they have a specific fund for, I think it's something like Broadway Cares COVID Emergency Relief Fund, something like that.
Exactly. So, and we have had the masks running for just a little over a week, and we are already close to donating $300. To Broadway Cares. So,
and just know that the profits, and this is no shade toward TeePublic, no shade toward anyone or anything, but the profit margin is not huge. It's just that you guys bought a lot. You are crazy amazing.
No,
yes.
You guys are amazing. That's what I'm saying. I'm like, amazing. So we are so excited that you guys have partnered with us in making this kind of a difference for struggling artists. And sorry, I'm a little misty. But to keep the momentum going, we added another item this week to, because, you know, you can only own so many masks, right? We don't expect you to just keep buying masks ad nauseum. So this week we've added a t-shirt to the mix, which is our logo, which is very similar to some t-shirts that we had mocked up for just my sister and I for when we started going to Comic-Con a few years ago. So they are very similar to that in the same thread. And if you have ever wanted to have a branded Outlander podcast t-shirt, please feel free to visit the site at TeePublic and look at them. And if you would enjoy them, please, please purchase. And we would love to be able to continue to donate to such a great cause.
Yeah. So I'm really excited. And again, in case you will, we hope you, if you listen to our show, you listen to the read-along, you heard last week's episode. But since we haven't actually done this yet, and I think our first payout, because we didn't join until the beginning of the store, until the beginning of July. So I don't believe our first payout is until mid-August. But what our plan is to do, and you guys have probably seen other people on social media some who are giving, you know, just trying to be upfront and accountable to people that they make promises to. The plan is, again, I won't know what it looks like until we actually get the money and we get, you know, know how things come through to the accounts and all that. But the intent is we will take a screenshot. We will make sure we don't include any personal information, but a screenshot of the total that is income. And then we will also do a screenshot, the donation page, when we actually do that for Broadway Cares. And we'll share those together. And we'll do that every month through the end of the year, or every time we get a payout through the end of the year, so that you guys can see what you have helped us be able to do.
And now, on to our read-along. This week, we will be continuing our A Breath of Snow and Ashes read-along with Chapter 7, entitled James Fraser, Indian Agent.
A lesser-known title for this chapter is Say Yes to the Dress. Will Jamie I'm pretty sure.
Are we sure it's not Roger and Brianna did it, so now Claire and Jamie have to do it? Because that's how it felt to me. Everyone gets to have sex.
Will Jamie say yes to the dress? Will he be an Indian agent? So what is an Indian agent? McDonald seemed to think he was doing Jamie a favor by asking him. And we learn through the text that an Indian agent, quote, is what it sounds like. A fellow who goes out and parleys with the local Indians, giving them gifts and talking them round in hopes that they'll be inclined to ally themselves with the crown's interests, whatever those might happen to be, unquote. All this against the backdrop of them getting ready for bed, declothing each other. There's a southern aunt.
And doing it.
Yeah, that too. Well, they don't have a lot of conversation while they're doing it. As a matter of fact, all we hear is, or all we read is afterwards, or later that night. There's a southern and northern department of the colonies. When I first read it, I thought he meant like of the state or of the colony. I'm like, that's a lot. But no, it's of the colonies, of all 13 colonies. There's a southern department and a northern.
This had to be like the 50 Shades of Grey chapter for this book because of the way the doing it went down.
Okay. We haven't gotten to the doing it, but I know Summer's anxious to talk about it. We will get there. So there's a southern and a northern department that deals with Indian affairs in the colonies. The southern department, which of course North Carolina colony would be a part of, is run by John Stewart, an Inverness man. McDonald thinks that, you know, because all Scots know each other, thinks that they'll, or at least Highlanders know each other, that they'll get along. And I wrote LOL, because someone's from the same place means they know each other, well, not know each other, that they're going to be close enough and totally hit it off, right? Right, totally. Megan P. writes, I think I can get behind the mental picture of Jamie Fraser as an Indian agent. He has already had some successful rapport with the Indians in this area and will have the added benefit of young Ian's experience as well. That's a good point, Megan. We will see if Jamie goes through with this and if young Ian has anything to do with it. But yes, if nothing else, he will absolutely have the benefit of picking young Ian's brain. Erica B. writes, Jamie hired on as an Indian agent seems right up his alley, I think. He is a man who deeply respects the native peoples and has an established history dealing with them. A definite good choice for the job. Back to the almost doing it, because we got to keep Summer entertained.
Please keep me entertained.
She unbraids his hair and massages his head and more convo. Remember I said it started as, most of the chapter it's a backdrop. So it hasn't happened quite yet. But does the crown provide these gifts? So if the Indian agent is supposed to go and parleys with the Indians to try and butter them up, basically be friendly, be nice to them and bring them gifts and hopes that they will eventually, when there's an issue, fight for the side that you want them to fight for or back them up. So does the crown provide these gifts? Yeah, not so much. But there is a possibility in doing well in trade. So Jamie personally could benefit as an Indian agent, right? He and the Ridge could benefit. So, you know, maybe. And Claire counters, well, as well as opportunities for corruption. Yes, that too.
I mean, there's always a benefit in making new friends. However, there's always a downside when you're hitting for the wrong team and then having to try to walk that line and you know you're going to change sides at some point, right? So how long do you keep pretending to be the crown's man when you know you need to switch sides?
Okay, yeah. Summer is, again, I can't think of the word. She's not stealing thunder because she has every right to talk about what she wants to talk about because we're talking about the same chapters. But yeah.
Am I jumping ahead like a rude person?
A little bit, but
look,
not.
I wanted to talk about what I want to talk about. I mentioned the 50 Shades of Grey sex scene that's coming up where he basically tells her to put her hands above her head and put her legs just so. And he was very
We got a little bit to go for.
You know, do what I want. And you kept saying sex scene. And that's what I was feeding off of that. And then you mentioned the Indian agents. And I was feeding off of that. I am just feeding off of you, Ginger. You're leading this conversation.
I never mentioned the sex scene. I said, Jamie says yes to the dress. I never mentioned sex scene. I'll show you my notes. I never mentioned it. Anywho's
all. You said something about him doing it.
No. I said that after you said something.
Maybe I did.
You did. blah, 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 blah. So he doesn't know if he'll do it. Jamie doesn't know if he'll say yes to the dress. He's considering it. But he says, what about the Wild West and cowherds? And of course, that was funny. He means cowboys. Claire mm-hmm. confirms that, yes, the Native Americans will be virtually wiped out. And this is, I mean, I don't have much to say. I have mixed feelings about this, but I can kind of see, because it's so far from, well, it's actually not that far, but Claire's time is so far from his time that it's really not, and it won't really affect his reality. So I can kind of get his response, but it's not a beautiful response. Does it trouble Jamie that Native Americans will be virtually wiped out? And he says no. He says, quote, it's not as though I should be doing them to death with my own hands, unquote. That's not quite the point, Jeremy. But yeah, okay. So the time is coming where they'll have to make up their minds and, quote, walk betwixt the fires, unquote. Which was the name of an episode for season 5, right? Between Two Fires?
Something like that. I think, yes, Between Two Fires. I was like, betwixt? I was like, I don't remember.
No, and there was no walking.
A single episode called Betwixt.
Honey, do you need to get down? Because I can't hold you like this, baby girl. I can't hold you like this, baby girl.
Hold me like that, baby girl.
Stop it. Don't do that, because I got to leave that stuff in. It's too funny not to keep.
You absolutely
Again,
do.
We're sisters, not lovers. Enough.
I know how you hold your cat. Well,
exactly. And we're definitely not doing that.
I mean, I don't want you to kiss my face repeatedly. I'm just saying a snuggle now and then would be nice.
No. Post, yes. When we all are vaccinated up the June, I will lick your face.
Please don't. That's too far.
I don't lick my cats either. That's gross. So,
mm-hmm. Thank you.
To become an agent would mean making a public step to the side of the crown. But that would be dangerous as the future drew nearer. They couldn't wait too long to ally themselves with the rebels for himself and his family. Erica B. writes, I find it fascinating and interesting the amount of strategy is required for Jamie and Claire to balance their lives between where they have to be, fighting for the crown, and where they want to be, on the side with the rebels. Nothing can be an easy decision for them, it seems. I would actually think it's almost the other way around. It's not that they want to be. I mean, yes, as far as wanting to be on the right side of history, it's that they know they have to be, right? You can get killed on either side, but they know they have to be. They have to make a choice. Jamie, since he's the male and the leader there, he will have to make the choice for liberty at some point.
I mean, if he wants to live.
Well, that's what I'm saying. You could live on either side. Not all Brits were killed. Come on.
No, you're not wrong. But it's like you have, if you want to stay there and you want to keep what you've built to date and you want to continue the life that you have
and
been
you know
cultivating,
the outcome. Correct.
You have to make the right choice. Yeah.
Yes.
There's, I mean, if you want to be a part of the building of the country your daughter will one day be raised in, you have to make that decision. But again, like I said, and like you said, when is that moment?
And I
too soon?
I'm arguing, well, and that's the thing. And I think that's what Erica's trying to say. I think Erica's trying to say it must be incredibly difficult to find this balance of to do what we need to do to not just live right now, but to, and not even necessarily to thrive right now, but to not basically show our cards too soon, right? How to balance between that until the point where we know we're going to be like pissing off the crown. We could make enemies, but we know we have to be on this right side, which is the side of liberty. And they, I don't think they have a problem with it fundamentally. It's just, it's like once you go there, you can't go back. And yeah. So, but I think Erica, if I'm wrong, correct me, but it sounds like the basis of what you're saying is you are recognizing it's that the key word you said was balance. It is very difficult. You're right. It involves an amazing amount of strategy for them to balance between what they feel they have to do right now and what they, as I said, not show their cards too soon, and what they know they will end up doing.
And think about how hard it is for them, because they know broad strokes, right? They understand broad strokes of the American Revolution. They do not understand all of the ins and outs of every tiny fight. So everything they encounter has to be weighed and measured against whether this is the moment. And you won't know it's the moment until it's past, right? You won't know until it's too late. So all you can do is really your best and hope that you aren't making the decision too late or too soon. And they won't know that until it's already passed.
Hence the difficulty in balancing. So I totally see that. I'm holding my cat right now. You may or may not be able to hear her purring. And I went to kiss her face because I kiss them. Like I said, I kiss them all the time. And I reached forward and almost kissed the mic. That's fun. I didn't. I stopped myself. But
it might be covered in cat fur.
Oh,
like
girl,
most
if it's
are.
In my house, I'm just kidding.
It's covered in cat fur. So just so you know, and for the listeners who didn't know, Ben is up here in the mountains with me now. Not, you know, home alone. Not home alone in my duplex in Sacramento. So he's up where we've been quarantining with us now. And he does not like closed doors. He's used to the existence of the duplex where the doors are pretty much open at all times and he can go where he wants. And now, anytime a door is closed, it's constant scratch, 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 and then meowing and whatever. So he's in the room right now because he was scratching on the door. So he may be obnoxious, and I apologize in advance.
Claire says he could always persuade some tribes to support the American side or even stay neutral. And Claire is firm when Jamie asks her. No, the English will not win. He I can't believe he even like had the cojones to like even say, like, are you sure?
He's like, are you sure?
She does hypothesize, though, that if they'd won, it would likely have been better for the native populations. And she says, quote, the British Empire did generally manage to run its colonies without entirely exterminating the native people in them, unquote. To which Jamie replies, quote, bar the heathen folk, unquote.
I mean, they didn't go into India and completely get rid of all of the Indians in their, you know, colonies. I would say that Claire is right. Historically, if you look at the other British colonies, they weren't generally massacring the people. They were not being nice to them while they were there, and they were not being treated as well as the British people they planted there to, you know, usurp their governments and controls and things, but they weren't genociding for the most part.
So this little conversation, and it's actually a big conversation, but the little tiny exchange that I just read between Jamie and Claire made me think of much larger, and it's a fantastical conversation because it's like alternate history. So it didn't happen. And so someone might say, you know, what's the worth? Like, why even consider it? Because I find it, while no one knows because it didn't happen, I find it fascinating. The discussion of what would have happened if the British had won the American Revolution. So, and I posted a little bit about this a few days ago in our Facebook group. I forget what I shared, but I did say it was in that we would be talking about it. So from an article entitled, What if America Lost the Revolution? Quote, and it's from How Stuff Works. And I will also be providing links to anything anything I quote or just mention, I will be providing links for. Quote, if the British had thwarted the American Revolution, the consequences for America might have been terrifyingly harsh. After all, during the war, the British Army demonstrated a penchant for brutality. When a small force of colonial rebels waved the white flag and tried to surrender at Waxhaw, South Carolina, in May 1780, the Redcoats simply slaughtered them, killing more than 100 men. In New York, which remained under Loyalist control, the Brits jammed American captives into the holds of prison ships, where they were given nothing but British sailors' discarded table scraps to eat, and were denied access to sunshine and fresh air. Though the conditions on these prison ships weren't necessarily that much worse than any conditions the Redcoats endured as prisoners of war, the number of dead was extraordinary. 11,000 prisoners perished there from diseases like yellow fever and dysentery. What might the British have done to the 100,000 or so Americans who had dared to take up arms against the crown? Had the British been victorious, it seems likely that King George III would have come through on the promise he made in 1775 to, quote, bring to condign punishment to authors, perpetrators, and abettors of such treacherous designs, unquote. The British had executed the leaders of a failed Scottish rebellion in 1747, and it seems likely that they would have marched George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, and other American revolutionaries to the gallows as well. One of the reasons for the rebellion was the colonists' fear that the British government would increase their taxes. That was ironic because after adopting the U.S. Constitution, the Americans went on to tax themselves at much higher rates than the 1% or so of colonial economic output that the British took by imposing the Navigation Acts. But had the revolution failed, the British might have punished the rebels by making them pay additional reparations for the cost of suppressing the revolt, a total of about £80 million, the equivalent of a roughly $4.9 billion in today's U.S. dollars. So post-war colonial America might have been a pretty hungry, impoverished place, with food crops being sold off or shipped to England. The result might have been widespread famine, akin to what occurred in Ireland in the 1840s. Additionally, the British might have punished American rebels by seizing their personal land and homes, such as they seized the estates of Scottish nobles who'd supported a rebellion against British rule. That would have radically altered the power structure in American society. Some of that land might have gone to the Hessian mercenaries the British imported from Germany to help them in the war. In one 1778 proclamation, the British promised each Hessian captain who brought 40 men an 800-acre estate, and each individual soldier would receive another 50 acres. So, it's a conversation, and the reason to me it's specifically interesting to talk about in light of us talking about Outlander is because we know exactly, I mean, things may have been, you know, of course, slightly different, right? Like slightly different. But we know how 18th century British dealt, the government dealt with a rebellion. We know it is the story of Outlander, right? It is the story of Outlander. So it's a very interesting conversation to, it's all speculation, of course, but I think you have evidence by what the British government already did. So what do you think, Sam? Does that make you, do you think that it would have gone this similar way?
I mean, I kind of already touched on this a little bit, and I mean, I'm not 100% right. I'm not a historian. I only know the things that I have read for pleasure and things that I wanted to read. So it's not like I sat down and was forced to read all the things that happened from this period to this period with British colonialism. I don't have a degree in that. I have books that I've read that take place in those times. And then, you know, you've seen some things over the years. So, I mean, there are other British colonies that you could use as examples. And this was a British colony. And I think that if you try to use Scotland as an example of a British colony, it's not the same thing because they shared a landmass.
Yes, but what's the word when you have soldiers in your country? It is, invaded.
Occupied?
Say it again. Yeah, exactly. So yes, so Scotland was occupied, definitely.
Correct. But I would never have called Scotland a colony, a British colony.
Oh, no. And I wasn't saying
and
it
we
was
have
a colony.
Lots of other I know, but we have lots of other examples of British colonies that you can look at that for, I don't believe, and again, I am not a scholar of anything really. I don't believe that we have seen the type of genocide that we saw with, you know, Native Americans, with the American rule that we've had, that they did in like other British colonies. Like, I don't, they didn't do mass genocide in India.
They did in Scotland, though.
That's, they didn't, like I said, they didn't, they, but Scotland was not a colony.
I understand that, but it was,
that is my point.
I understand. And I think you have a point.
And I think that you can only, there's only so much you can do with a colony on a different continent. And I think that when it is your northern neighbor who you used to be buddies with,
and who's a lot closer and who can hurt you a lot more. Yeah.
Right. And you have more access to your own food, well-being. It's a lot easier to start a land battle on your own turf and in your own continent when you're just a border away than it is to do that across oceans and on separate continents. So I don't know that they would have been able to enact and follow through on the same type of genocide event that they did in Scotland in their other colonies. If they'd wanted to, it would have been harder and it would have been a much larger and taxing endeavor.
So back to the chapter. Claire urges Jamie to chat with Roger, who is very knowledgeable about this subject matter. And Jamie tells her that he thinks Bree and Roger, by the way, went to the McGillivrys to get Jem. And then he fondles his weapons, literally, all of his guns and everything, and he puts a dirk, as they get closer to approaching the bed, he puts a dirk under his pillow. So apparently, the poor major cannot escape Adso, even in slumber. So Adso, remember, the major's visiting, because like once you get there, you're going to have to spend the night. You can't go anywhere. It takes like 3 days to walk anywhere. But he's spending the night. He's a guest. So he's, I think, across the hall from them. And the door is closed. But probably during the rest of the day, or at some point, Adso had, you know, gotten in. They think Adso's in the major's room. Maybe he got in through an open window. Because remember, last time we heard about Adso, even if not by name, it was when Rollo had jumped out the window, the surgery window, to go tree a cat.
I personally envision Adso hiding under the bed or taking a nap under the bed. And maybe that's just because that's what my cat does. He hides under the bed and takes naps. And then the minute the door shuts, he comes out and he's like, what is this then?
So the major has thrown Rollo out. Like, first he throws a shoe against, trying to hit him, and probably hits a wall of the door. And then he throws Adso out. And Jamie lets him in. And then Adso jumps into the wash stand and just begins to lick his balls.
As you do.
And Jamie ends us with, quote, I saw a man once in Paris who could do that, unquote. And though Claire warns Jamie, Jamie thinks that the major wouldn't have hurt Adso. He really wants Jamie for an agent. He's like, yeah, he may not want him like on his scratching him, but I ain't going to hurt him because he needs you.
It's more than that. I'm not going to hurt him because he's not my cat. You don't go to somebody else's house and hurt their cat or their animals. That's just a bad guest thing. Now, granted, it's a bad host thing to not, you know, to harass your guests with your crazy animals. But as a guest, you don't hurt your host's animals ever. You won't get invited back.
Yes, but I don't think it was ever, well, we know it was not, his intent was to go ask Jamie to be an Indian agent. His intent was not to go hurt the cat. But if the cat is hurting him, he has a right to try and protect himself. But yeah, I don't think he would ever try and hurt the cat on purpose. So I don't think that's even part of a... Erica B writes, this moment just made me laugh. Classic relatable moment for all cat owners. That is the truth, girl.
How appropriate. I want you to know one thing, Ginger. Okay. I was driving in my car today down to town to get some provisions at the store. And I heard on Sirius XM channel, whatever, that I was listening to, I think it was 60s on 6, that today is National Kitten Day. So it's really only appropriate that we have cat issues personally to talk about that happened while we're recording, as well as a chapter about Adso being a typical cat.
Oh, yes. Well, that fair enough. And I will say, I think you guys noticed in the, I mean, I still try to like edit out me like yelling at a cat, or if there's a like a cat fight or something, like things that are really easy, either really major, really loud, really annoying, or really easy to edit out, I do my best to edit out. But I think I said in the last episode or two episodes ago that, like, if you heard that just now, that was the cat food door opening, because they have auto cat feeders that are connected or hooked up with their RFID tag thing. And so whenever they approach it, the correct feeder, it opens. So I used to, for a number of months, like unplug them if I remembered, but I'm like, I just can't. Like, if I'm recording an audiobook, I have to, because people are going to pay for that. And it's not because you guys don't pay for the show. It's just we do this so often, I don't remember. And the one time, a few times I've unplugged them and forgotten to plug them back in, and the cat's like missed two meals. So yeah, if you hear it, I apologize in advance. It can't come out because it's on the same track that I'm talking. And now it's closing. Anyway, I think I said last episode that, and it's open. I think I said last episode that, like I said, unless it's big and bothersome and can, you know, is outside of summer and it's closing, is outside of summer and me talking, it's just, I'm not worried about cat sounds. I'm not worried about meows anymore. I'm not worried about purrs anymore. Like, I can't lock, like summer kind of, if I lock my cats or lock them, if I put them in the bedroom, there will be scratches and meows, and you will hear the meows even 20 feet from 20 feet away. So it's just not worth the effort. So yeah, it's happy National Kitten Day.
Hi, baby girlfriends.
The real reason they believe that the major wants Jamie for an agent is to get in with the goodies on the new governor. So Jamie, meaning he wants to get in on the, not in cahoots, but get in on the good side of the new governor. So Jamie's basically won a bet that as to why McDonald would want him as an agent. And so what does he want since he won the bet? He wants to go downtown. But then he changes his mind and they relax and then they do it. And that's me saying how they did it. So, Summer, if you want to talk about any more detail, go for it.
I already did.
Oh, so twice. We don't need
to. We're good. I had my piece. I said my piece about
twice.
This.
We're good. Summer, mm-hmm. You're too funny. Okay. So they did it. Then, both of them, still thinking of the Dutch cabin, he asks her if she'd do what the Dutch woman had done. And she's like, huh? And then Jamie lays out the scene at the cabin eerily. He believes what happened was those men, those banditti, came. The husband fought them and was killed. Quote, and when she saw her man was gone, I think she told the men she must feed the weans before, dot, dot, dot. And then she put the toadstools into the stew and fed it to the bairns and her mother. She took the two men with them. But I think it was that was the accident. She only meant to follow him. She wouldn't leave him there alone. Unquote. This is what I wrote, and I think later on what Jamie says, he actually clears this up. But what I wrote was, so does she, meaning Jamie talking about the Dutch woman, does she mean that the wife or mother meant to kill her kids and mom so they wouldn't have to witness her being raped and potentially murdered, or to save them from other abuse, or I guess all of it? Also, what does Jamie mean by, I think that was the accident, she only meant to follow him? Follow who? The husband? Like follow him into death? She wouldn't leave him there alone, meaning the dead, her husband dead in the cabin? Is that what you took away?
What I took away from this is the exact conversation that you and I had like 2 or 3 weeks ago when we were at the Dutch cabin burning and we were saying, do you think it happened?
Chapter two.
What do you think happened? I mean, I feel like they know no more or no less really than we do.
No.
As readers.
I'm not saying are they right. But Jamie just painted a picture of how he believed it could have happened. I'm saying, according to Jamie, when he says she only meant to follow him,
That's how he interprets it. That's what I'm saying. I feel like those two are having the same conversation that you and I had when we were trying to puzzle out if we thought it was on purpose, if we thought it was an accident. I don't think anyone got clear pictures.
You don't know what he meant when he said she only meant to follow him. That's my question.
If she made a meal with poisonous mushrooms, as Jamie is positing that she did, she fully intended for all of her family to die with them and to not leave him going to the other world alone. That's the only way you can interpret that. If she made a poisonous mushroom dish, fed it to the men and to her children and ate it herself, if she did that on purpose, she fully intended for her husband to not cross over alone.
That's all I was asking. So the reason he brings this up, and then this is where I thought it kind of maybe answered my question to what did he mean by saying what he said. Jamie's afraid he might die too soon and fail, meaning fail help with the rebellion, fail them, whatever that means. And as he falls asleep, he says, "If I die, dinna follow me. The barons will need ya. Stay for them. I can wait." So when he says, "Dinna follow me,"
Did that scream Hamilton to you? My love, take your time.
I mean, yeah.
Everything does right now. Because Hamilton's streaming online, y'all. Go watch it. If you haven't, how have you not watched it? And if you're not already a Disney Plus subscriber, and I don't have any skin in this game. I am not being paid by anyone to say this. But if you do not have Disney Plus already, meaning I don't have kids, I don't have people that want to watch that garbage. I'm not into that kind of stuff. Mandalorian, Schmandalorian, who cares? If you are not one of those people who already subscribes to Disney Plus for the low, low price of $6.99, you can have a 1 month subscription to Disney Plus and watch Hamilton, the show. And I would also like to point out that to get seats that good, first of all, you won't ever see that level of detail if you go to see the show in the theater. But even seats to Hamilton when it's actually touring, not on Broadway, touring, like it's not even like the original cast. And this is almost the entire original cast. There were a couple of original cast members who had already left. They were ensemble members, I believe. But this is almost the entire original cast of Hamilton. You can't even get good seats for $6.99. You can't get bad seats for $6.99. If all you ever watch is Hamilton once, you got your money's worth. I promise. I promise. I promise.
Well, hold on. And if you're a new customer, there's usually like a 1 week trial period.
Maybe. I don't know. I'm not a new customer. I believe that we have Verizon, so we got a free Disney Plus subscription had passed. So when I logged into it, they wanted me to pay them. So I paid them $6.99. And it was the best $6.99 I have ever spent to date this month. No, not yet. I'm planning to watch it a few more times.
Megan P. writes, "I hope I'm half as frisky in my old age as Claire and Jamie still seem to be. Their connection has always been earthy and natural, and it doesn't ever seem to waver. In light of this connection, Diana leaves us with yet another poignant and perfectly trademark quote from Jamie. Great chapter." And Eric B. closes us out with, "Jamie has a late night revelation and concern after their lovemaking, wanting to be sure Claire wouldn't kill herself and the family if Jamie died. But also, it's out of curiosity of the truth with the Dutch woman and her family. Did she kill them all on purpose? The jury is still out, I think. The story he lays out is something that could have definitely happened, definitely makes you think. These two have lots of meaningful conversations in their bed. I find that interesting. I never do."
I would just like to say, beds are for sleeping. One. Two, I believe that Jamie was dead before to Claire, and she didn't kill herself then. She's not going to do it now. Also, she made a very strong pledge to do no harm. I can't see herself killing her children or herself, because that is harm. So while they were both...
without necessity or any kind of euthanasia.
Right.
Yeah.
While they were both affected by what they witnessed at the Dutch camp, I do not believe she would ever do anything like that, personally. And that was the end of part one. Y'all, we are in part two. There are lots of parts. Don't get excited. We are in part two. This one is entitled A Gathering of Shadows, and we will begin with chapter 8.
Wait.
What?
Oh, sorry. I got the chapter. I'm like, that is not the chapter.
I'm
sorry,
not there the yet. The we will be beginning.
I'm like, I didn't read that chapter.
You did,
so
I promise. Calm your lady bits. Calm down. We will be beginning this part with chapter 8 entitled Victim of a Massacre.
Mail call. It's a letter from Lord John, y'all, to the Jamester.
Ronje.
In the beginning of the letter. Yeah. Beginning of the letter, quote, I write you in good health. Reminds me of a line from Hamilton. Like, I even said that in kind of a rhythm. I write you in good health or something like that. Like, oh my God, I can't not hear Hamilton when I see these things.
It's not from James Reynolds. He's not about to be extorted.
No. I know, but I was like, what? Cato writes, I always appreciate a letter chapter, especially from Lord John. It always gives us a date and a general idea of where we are in the grand scheme of history. And that is true. His letters are, or letters in general, but especially Lord John's letters between like books 4 and 5, I guess starting with book 4, at least in book 5, but definitely going forward. Absolutely help paint the picture, remind us where we are, and paint the background. So we're focused on basically Fraser's Ridge and then what's going on with the Frasers and the Mackenzies, and we follow them where they go. But we're pretty much stuck with them, happily so. And Diana does this through letters in general, but Lord John's are some favorites, and also things like newspaper clippings and that kind of thing that are being, you know, read or that arrive 6 months later on the bridge or something like that. So let's see what's going on in the colonies. Okay, it's always a good idea to make note of any time reference at the beginning of chapters because we don't always get them, but we get them a sure heck of a lot more than we do in the TV series, huh, stars?
And when we get them, they're generally right. Weren't there a couple of like dates put on the bottom of a screen in episodes where they're like, no, that's not right?
Oh, girl. There was one tweet that was deleted, but I can't. It's too much. Yeah, I don't know. The date the letter was written on is April 14th, 1773, and here's the bullets. Willie returned to England to complete his education. John finds the quiet oppressive, and he misses Willie. And John's become a vintner. That's it. That's the letter. Those are the bullets of people we know. Now, for some more background. First of all, Kate O writes, there is something endearing about Lord John, the empty nester. That's true. I agree. So what are some stuff that's gurn earn? As Lord John writes about his new servant, Bobby Higgins, he gives his background. And his background includes a bit about the Boston Massacre. And so that's the medium, I guess, that we learn not only what's been going on in the colonies, it places us within the time frame of the revolution, or the coming revolution, but also, you know, kind of teaches us stuff or gives us another vantage point from which to view certain things that we may have been taught happened a certain way. So remember, Gray is biased. Every writer is biased. All books are biased. I don't care who writes them. Every article is biased. Every textbook. Lord John Gray is biased and is an honorable soldier. He is loyal to the crown. It is not surprising that he would side with the soldiers in his description of the Boston Massacre. But it is very reasonable to believe that it's a lot grayer than black and white in general. Things usually are. And the Boston press definitely had a field day. So I will share with you an article on history.com. It is linked in the show notes, and it will be a very decent description of the events of the Boston Massacre.
Come on, Kiva. Girl, I cannot keep this back and forth. You gotta go. Come on, baby girlfriend. I love you. Go away, please.
I say that to my boyfriend all the time.
I love you.
Go away, please. Things my sister says to her cats that are absolutely appropriate to say to your significant other. I love you. Go away, please.
I love you so much. You're so cute.
I
want to eat your face.
I can see that you want to crawl up on my boobs, but we're not going to do that right now. You can also say that to your boyfriend.
Summer. Lord John describes the events, how the soldiers after the events were not found guilty of the charges, but two of the soldiers were convicted of manslaughter. This is the book now, including Bobby Higgins. He writes, quote, Higgins, with one other, was convicted of manslaughter, but pled clergy and was released after his branding. So Diana chose to change history slightly, of course. I mean, this is not uncommon. It happens all the time. There were, if you read that article that I will link to from history.com, there were actually two men. There were five men who arrested who were not found guilty, but two men were found guilty of manslaughter. And so this is taken straight from history, but Diana changes the names and a few other things. Quote, two of them, Hugh Montgomery and Matthew Kilroy, were found guilty of manslaughter and were branded on the thumbs as first offenders per English law, unquote. So I'm curious as to why she had him branded on the face instead of on the thumb. I'm guessing because not just poetic license, artistic license, but also because if you're branded on your thumb, it's easy to hide, right? And thus there would be less conflict with the character of Bobby Higgins. So it makes sense that she would, you know, move it to the face. And also I'm sure that there were that there was a custom of a certain type of branding. I don't think she made that branding up. But in history, these two very real men who were present and convicted of manslaughter from the Boston Massacre were found guilty, but they were, as first offenders per English law, they were only branded on the thumbs and released. So that's Bobby Higgins in the book. But he did not get his thumb branded. He got his face branded. So he goes on to say that Higgins, quote, pled clergy and was released after branding. So what does this mean? I looked it up for y'all, for me all. In English law, and I will, this is a, okay, I'm not talking about the wonderfulness of Wikipedia. When I do use Wikipedia, it is not as a source, although what I'm reading you is from there. When I use Wikipedia, I use it to find other sources. So the sources that are used at the bottom, and I still check them as well. But a lot of times someone who's gone to the trouble of writing an article on Wikipedia will have actually legit sources that they've used to compile that article. So I would never cite an article on Wikipedia, but again, we're not writing academic papers here. I would absolutely use Wikipedia as kind of a medium.
Like a jumping off point.
Medium-ish cut. Exactly. I don't want to say a shortcut, although it could be a shortcut, but like a medium cut maybe, to medium long cut, to get you started on finding some sources. So I did not dive deep into those, but they had some really great sources, which you guys can check out if you want once you get this article. So in English law, the benefit of clergy, in law Latin or legal Latin, privilegium clericale, was originally a provision by which clergymen could claim that they were outside the jurisdiction of the secular courts and be tried instead in an ecclesiastical court under canon law. Various reforms limited the scope of this legal arrangement to prevent its abuse, including branding of a thumb upon first use, to limit number of invocations for some. So that would make sense. So they branded your thumb so they could see if you had been already had one incident after pleading clergy. Eventually, the benefit of clergy evolved into a legal fiction in which first-time offenders could receive lesser sentences for some crimes, the so-called clergyable ones. The legal mechanism was abolished in 1827 with the passage of the Criminal Law Act. And, furthermore, at first, in order to plead the benefit of clergy, one had to appear before the court tonsured and otherwise wearing ecclesiastical dress. Over time, this proof of clergyhood was replaced by a literacy test. Defendants demonstrated their clerical status by reading from the Latin Bible. This opened the door to literate lay defendants also claiming the benefit of clergy. In 1351, under Edward III, this loophole was formalized in statute, and the benefit of clergy was officially extended to all who could read. For example, the English dramatist Ben Jonson avoided hanging by pleading benefit of clergy in 1598 when charged with manslaughter. In the New World of the British colonies, the two soldiers convicted of manslaughter in the 1770 Boston Massacre were spared execution for manslaughter under the benefit of clergy, but underwent branding of their right thumbs to prevent them from invoking the right in any future murder case. So, even though that article was not about the Boston Massacre, it mentions it because that is a well-known historical example of this thing. So it began as literally you had to be a member of the clergy to use this defense or this plea. And then for it to be believed, to prove it, you had to be tonsured, which means have your hair cut a certain way, became. And then those who were clergy would have obviously been able to read Latin. This changed into a layperson, meaning a non-cleric, a non-priest, a non-religious. A lay person who could read Latin would also be able to plead clergy. So plead clergy began as legit, I'm clergy, and then morphed into I'm literate-ish. So we don't know what they did. Diana doesn't go into it, and we don't need it for the story, but it's interesting. So it makes me wonder if this is now, if it's reading Latin or if even just reading English. I have no idea. They don't tell us. Diana does not tell us what Bobby had to do to prove that he was eligible for pleading clergy. But it's fascinating that this article about pleading clergy mentions the Boston Massacre. So we have these different things like citing each other. And that is, as I said, a Wikipedia article with some really great resources in it or sources. And that was Benefit of Clergy. Elizabeth Kay writes, I really like that Diana put the Boston Massacre from the perspective of Lord John, an English soldier. I don't know how this is taught in schools now, but my memories from grade school are of learning about the righteous, innocent patriots and the horrible, violent English. Of course, as I got older and went on to be a history minor in college, I learned that things are rarely, if ever, that simple. History is written by the victors, of course. I often wonder how events unfolding now will appear to future historians. Future historians wonder how Eliza reacted. Sorry, guys. It's there. Elizabeth continues. I think there are many people who would agree that the Patriots were naturally on the right side, fighting for freedom and liberty. But I suspect that in reality, had they been around at the time, those same people would actually view the Sons of Liberty as an unruly mob, a bunch of malcontents.
I thought you were going to say mouth breathers. Don't know why.
We can't ever truly know what our reaction would have been unless we were living in the situation at the time. Anyway, Bobby Higgins is clearly based on either, and see, she read it too, Matthew Kilroy or Hugh Montgomery, as noted in the website Perspectives on the Boston Massacre, Massachusetts Historical Society. So Elizabeth also did some diving and read about it, and she actually gave a pretty long quote from this article. I do not believe she provided a link, but I did not include her entire quote because it was almost the same information that I shared from my sources, but she did look it up, and that is her, the source is there if you want to Google it. It's, the website is Perspectives on the Boston Massacre, Massachusetts Historical Society. So thank you so much, Elizabeth. Elizabeth Kay says, I had to look it up because any American history classes I had were a long time ago. And the last thing I saw on the Revolution was the HBO series on John Adams, who was the defense lawyer for the soldiers, which is fascinating. And from what I remember of the series, it made it seem as if all the soldiers were found not guilty. Kate O. writes, the Boston Massacre, as told by someone who is not an American history textbook, I say that with all sincerity regarding Lord John's take. The story of the Boston Massacre that we hear up until we get a more nuanced version of the story from a well-studied history professor in college reads more like redcoat monsters mow down innocent Boston residents, unquote. And that's not at all how it went. John Adams was even the defense attorney for some of the accused British soldiers. I also see this as the spark of Jamie and Claire being on one side or the other of this conflict. They aren't there yet, but you can see that the moment is coming. And then we find out from Lord John in the letter that Higgins was discharged from the army, had no means of making a living. He was beaten, sustained injuries, and including losing the sight in one eye. And ultimately, he was engaged in service by Lord John. So And this letter he is sending with him, so Brianna Higgins, gracious, Bobby Higgins will is being sent with this letter, and he's also sending him with some, what, Brianna Higgins? Idiot. He is sending him with wine in hopes that Claire will examine his butt. Well, his eye, too. And he sends a prezi for Brianna, which we don't, if you've read, you know what it is, but I've forgotten because it's been a minute, a few months since I read. And he ends with love, J. Gray, Kate O. Finishes us out with Lord John's present to Brianna. All I have to say is that Roger shouldn't be worried about Lord John's familiarity with his wife, but with what that present is.
I mean, they yes, were engaged. I remember now.
Well, yeah, but come on, girlfriend.
I mean, I know. All right. And that was chapter 8. Join us next week when we will be continuing our A Breath of Snow and Ashes read along with chapter 9 entitled The Threshold of War. And as always, we still have some chapters up for grabs. If you're interested, you can go to www.outlanderpod.com/snow. You'll find a link to our Google Sheet that has all of the chapters availability. And if you want to shoot me an email at summer@outlanderpod.com, I will make sure that those get assigned to you very quickly. And if you want to continue the conversation and be part of our group, you can go to www.outlanderpod.com/group.
And again, a very special thanks to co-producer of this episode, Kate O. To find out more about what a co-producer is and what that all entails and how to become one, and just to find out how you could support us in a very special way on Patreon, visit outlanderpod.com/Patreon.
And if you'd like to visit our shop where you can help us support a worthy cause, Broadway Cares, Equity Fights AIDS, and this is their COVID subsidiary group to help support artists who are no longer gainfully employed and potentially do not have insurance and can't fight it if they do catch it, not without having hundreds of thousands of dollars, maybe even millions of medical bills, because people are not just generally checking in and checking out to the hospital. A lot of them are there for months at a time. And we have Broadway stars like Nick Cordero, who was tragically in the hospital for over 90 days until he finally lost his battle with COVID. And actually, he didn't lose his battle with COVID. He lost his battle with what COVID did to his body before it left him. So places like these, and this is one of the places that we've decided was a worthy enough cause to support things that supported us when we were younger. So if you want to join us and help us support this great cause, please go to www.outlanderpod.com/shop.
Thank you as always so much for listening. We look forward to our next episode. Thank you to our generous partner, Zencastr, who offers high-fidelity podcasting. Check out Zencastr and use coupon code OUTLANDER20, OUTLANDER20, for 20% off 3 months or 20% off for a year. Connect with us. Visit our website at outlanderpod.com. Find us on Facebook, facebook.com/outlanderpod. We'd love for you to join our Facebook community at outlanderpod.com/group. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at @outlanderpod.